My next guest, best known for building homes and DIY SOS or testing general knowledge on Who Dares Wins, Nick Knowles has turned his hand to nutrition now and well-being following his life-changing BBC Two series, The Retreat, with his new book, Proper Healthy Food. Good morning to you, Nick.
Good morning. You're coming for a bit of a stick this morning, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And we don't know each other, but I'm very fat, right? I'm very, very, very fat.
You're what's known as a unit, like me. We make good rugby players.
Yeah. So at what point did you decide you needed to do something about it?
When I was unwell, when I was on my way to record a new pilot series in a studio in London, I sneezed and started a nosebleed in the back of the car, and which didn't stop for 2 days, and had to have an operation to mend an artery that I'd blown in my sinuses. And when I'm talking to the doctor afterwards about what the contributing factors might be, he suggested that stress and being overweight and being unhealthy was probably the main thing. So I decided to go off to this retreat, having seen somebody who'd been to the retreat who looked about 10 years younger after they'd been there. And me being me, I took 10 people who were the least likely people to go to that kind of retreat, sort of taxi drivers and builders and very suspicious characters, who went off, and I'd measured them medically in the hospital at the beginning of the process and at the end to see if there was any noticeable difference. And the results were so outstanding that I decided to come back and become evangelical about it and try and get everybody, all the people who were at least likely to change their diet, to do something about it.
And before you started the healthier regime, did you realise yourself you were big?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've always been a big unit anyway. I was I'm 6 foot two.
You don't look fat and telly. You look tall.
I'm 6'2", but I'm also 106 kilos, which is sort of getting on for 17 stone. I've always carried it reasonably well, but for the last 4 or 5 years, the waistline's been getting a bit bigger, and I've gone from a 44 chest to a 46, and it's just generally putting a bit of weight on as I went, and always 34 inch waist, and suddenly was up around a 38, and thinking, well, I just need to get myself sorted out. So it was apparent that I wasn't eating very well. And I was a really big carnivore. So it was meat 3 times a day, sort of a sausage sandwich for breakfast, lunch probably had meat in it, dinner had meat in it. And if I could squeeze in a Scotch egg or a pork pie somewhere in between, then that was me on the run, or a sausage roll.
I mean, when the doctor, Nick, talked to you about stress, do you recognise stress in your life? Are you a stressed person?
Yeah.
Do you overstress?
Yeah, I'm what Terry Pratchett called a neurovore. I live on my nerves, so it's I'm always trying I've got the next scheme underway, the next thing that I'm up to, the next thing that I'm doing, and I don't sleep a great deal. My brain's always going a million miles an hour, and I kind of needed to get that under control a little bit. And certainly going to Thailand
is that not dangerous, not being able to sleep?
I think it probably is dangerous. This is why I recognise that it was it wasn't. It wasn't particularly good for me. All these things were combined. But chasing a TV career and all the other things. I write films, so I have a film company as well. I write history dramas. I do all kinds of odds and sods. And trying to keep things ticking over. And I think because I come from a fairly humble background, I grew up on a council estate in West London. And I assume that it's all about to finish. So I've always got, fingers in different pies and working on this and that and the other. And just had too much going on, really.
So here you are. Stand back from yourself for a second. So here you are. You can't turn the TV on, for goodness sake. I'm sick looking at you. You can't turn the TV on without you being there, okay? So you're playing at the top level. You're doing really, really well. And yet there's an insecurity there, which means you can't actually enjoy it as much as you should be, because you should be able to sleep. You should see yourself as successful. You should probably, take a bit of comfort from the fact that they want you. Why can't you think like that?
I think because I just don't think it's in me to do that. I think my dad used to work himself pretty much to death. In fact, he did pretty much work himself to death. But he looked after the family. And if you come from the background I do and suddenly find yourself able to earn like I do, then you have a responsibility to look after, make sure everybody in the family's okay, because these kind of opportunities just don't come along very often. So I kind of felt that responsibility when my dad moved on and passed on 20-odd years ago. Kind of felt a certain responsibility. My brother is by far and away the nicest man in the world, so he sort of gives the pastoral care. It was up to me to provide the sort of financial safety net that comes with doing what I do.
Is it a lack of self-belief?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just my mate Billy from DIYS says I have an altitude problem that I've got above myself. And I think actually there is a degree of altitude sickness when you do really well and you come from a humble background. You do always assume that someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and go, right, we've just realised that's enough. I mean, oddly enough, I was talking about this to Peter Jones, you know, the dragon.
Yeah.
And he was saying that despite having, you know, 200 or 250 companies and being a multi-squillionaire, he still gets up every morning and goes to work because he assumes it's all going to end tomorrow. And it's that drive, I think, from that background. Whereas I was chatting to Kelly Hoppen about the same thing with Peter Jones, and she was saying she doesn't feel that at all. But then she comes from a family who are comfortable in the first place. I think it's that drive that just happens to people that come from that kind of background.
So if I was to ask you then, Nick, why do you think the BBC are employing you? How would you answer that? Why are they choosing you above others?
I think probably, if I was to be honest, because I'm probably the most ITV presenter they have.
Yeah.
The BBC has a lot of people that come from, you know, from that sort of Oxbridge background, and I make a nice marker and I'm a nice change in amongst it. I've been reasonably successful over a period of time, and I have an ability, I think, probably to put my finger on the zeitgeist of whatever's happening at the moment. So, for example, going off to do this retreat in Thailand,
yeah,
and then coming back and changing my diet to a sort of veggie vegan diet, and then trying to cook that food, I suddenly found that actually when I went on the building site with 100, you know, I go, when we do an SOS, there's like 100, 150 builders who are all volunteering on site, and you would expect them to be fairly comical and mirth-filled at my sudden change in diet. But in actual fact, when I go around and do a tea and coffee run, which is the only thing I'm useful for very often late in the evening, when I go around and say tea or coffee, they're very often asking if I have a fruit tea or a chamomile or a rooibos. And it is probably embarrassing on building sites these days. But they genuinely, more men and more women are starting to think about their diet. So this book that I did was because I couldn't find the food I wanted. It actually seems to have hit a zeitgeist, and there's a lot of people thinking the same way at the moment.
I can't break the cycle of the bad food. I try so hard, or at least I think I do, and I can't get away from the crisps and the chocolate.
That's because your brain
genuinely think I'm addicted, and I think I've got to, you know.
I think what happens is, for those of us that do what we do, because we're in similar fields here, what happens is that in the evenings, rather than you actually closing you're slowing your mind down and actually becoming calmer in the evenings.
Well, by the way, I can't sleep, and I've got a television company, and I work around the clock 7 days a week.
And so what happens is, when your main work day is done, your head's going a million miles an hour in the evening, and that's when you're thinking up things and writing notes. I send emails to my PA saying, you've got to do this, got to do that. I'm thinking of everything has to be written down and done for the next day. Do things as you think about them. And I sit up till like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And that's when you start eating crisps and chocolate and rubbish. And
exactly.
And then you try and slow your brain down by watching rubbish TV or... mind you, you've got a night shift as well. I listen to you on Radio 5 and you do some fantastic interviews. But you do, you know, you're there in the evenings, you're burning the candle at both ends. And there comes a point where you've got to find another way around it. For me, the food was the starting point. But actually, one of the things that I found really helped me was meditation. When I went to Thailand and did this yoga food retreat, I was very wary of meditation because I thought, if I slow my brain down, I'm not going to be able to do what I do. I rely on the fact that my brain goes a million miles an hour
I know,
to do what I do.
I know some people will take offence at this, and it's not meant to be offensive. It's my ignorance more than anything else. But meditation feels to me like something that doesn't actually exist. One of these airy fairy, you know, things that stars probably like you say, you know, I meditate. And I kind
no,
of
no.
Like, what do you mean? You sit still? What is it? How does it help?
Okay, so Stephen, so you are me a year and a half ago. Literally, my brother spent 5 years trying to get me to do meditation, telling me it would help myself. And I literally tried twice by going to a class under pressure from my brother, where I sat, and in the first minute and a half of the hour-long class, all I could think of was, oh my God, I've got another 59 minutes of this rubbish. And when I went to Thailand and started doing the classes, and they tried to do meditation classes, I just walked out because I didn't want to know.
Yeah.
Luckily, I had a guy called Luke Bash, who was the yoga teacher. Now, yoga actually helped an enormous amount as well, because as you get older.
I like
and
his chubbier, surname, you become Bash. Less... What a surname, Bash.
Yeah. As you get older, you become less flexible, and that kind of doesn't help things in terms of feeling motivated as well. Yeah. So I was starting to do a bit of the yoga and sticking with that. The food was going quite well. I was managing with that. And he used to do this warm down at the end of the yoga lesson. It wasn't until I was about 2 weeks into this, I realised that what he was doing at the end of the lesson wasn't warming down and things. He was actually talking to us, and what he was doing was putting us into meditation. Now, I'd always been worried that A, it was a load of old codswallop and didn't exist, and B, if it did exist and I slowed my brain down, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. In actual fact, what it does is it means that when I practice that, which I haven't been doing just recently, but when I practice that, I sleep better. And when my brain does slow down slightly, I make better decisions. I'm no less quick in being able to do what I do. I'm no less able to manage the 400 things that are going on each day. I can just make better decisions, and I'm not as stressed, and I'm not as worn out. I don't wake up in the middle of the night with, like, sweaty pillows where my brain's been going a million miles an hour. That's, you know, I thought that was something. I'd spent so much time in Africa, I thought I'd maybe picked up
malaria. So what do you actually do?
Wasn't
it? So when you meditate, you sit still. Is it okay? And look, I'm sure lots of people, because you know this shouldn't be one of these dopey media discussions, right? So, you know, people who are working hard, you know, be it that they're an electrician, a plumber, whatever, a teacher, whatever, I'm sure they can identify with. You bring work home with you, okay?
Yep.
And I genuinely can't. I think it's a fundamental defect in my existence that I can't stop thinking. All right, I cannot go home. I am incapable of going home and not thinking about what am I doing next? What do I need to, what I need to create next? It's not good enough. So what do I need to do next?
That's why you're successful, Stephen.
Well, and I don't even think I'm successful. Let's not get into that, right? But anyway,
why can't you be generous to yourself? We've put the conversation around. I'm asking you the questions you asked me at the beginning. Remember, why can't you be confident in what you're doing?
I'm confident.
Why did the BBC employ you?
Well, the reason I would answer, quite frankly, why the BBC employ me is because I think I'm the most UTV person in BBC Northern Ireland, and I mean that. But anyway, that's why I smiled when you said it. But when you meditate, okay, because I want to actually try this now, I go home. So I will go home. I'm not well today. I will go home today, and probably in the afternoon, I'll start thinking of a new project.
Yep.
And it'll just be whizzing around my brain. And I'll go to watch telly tonight and I'll watch it. But after it, I'll be thinking of something else.
Yep.
Now, what do I do to take that out of my brain, to stop, to relax? What do I actually do?
If you start thinking about that, I mean, bear in mind, I'm not a meditation teacher, but if you start thinking about the fact that you are trying to meditate, that's the point at which it's not going to work anyway. So what you're doing is deconstructing in the way that you deconstruct everything else to work out what, you know, how to make a program, what to do, what's interesting, what's not, how you'd go about it. If you try and deconstruct things like that. So what you actually start with is breathing techniques to begin with. And it may sound very wishy-washy, sound very hippie,
yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that's how it works. When I was on location in Thailand, this teacher said to me, he said, okay, this is a yoga breathing technique. And I was like, seriously, I've been on the planet 52 years.
Yeah.
I don't need to learn how to breathe. He's like, no, you need to do this particular technique. It's called nostril breathing, and it will help you sleep. Now, literally, it's the most stupid thing in the world. Four nights, he said to me, he sent me off to try it. And the next day, he said, did you try it? I was like, yes. Did it help? I was like, no. He said, you didn't try it. I was like, why don't you try it? I said, because it's flipping ridiculous.
Yeah.
It cannot possibly work. Then on the fifth night, I finally thought, well, I'm here to give it a go. So I did the nostril breathing. And found I had the best night's sleep I'd had in 20 years. So it's about breath control. And in the breath control, breathing, I mean, very simply, you basically, if you look it up, you can probably look it up on YouTube and find it. Nostril control, you close one nostril, breathe in, close the other nostril, breathe out. You breathe in for 4 seconds, you breathe out for 8 seconds on each breath. You do that for about 2 or 3 minutes, you'll sleep better tonight. Honestly, it's that simple. It's ridiculous. I've actually now handed this technique on to, it must be 30, 40 people since I came back, all of whom think it sounds like a load of old codswallop, all of whom, when they finally try it, then send me an email saying, I had the best night's sleep last night. So look it up, nostril breathing. I know it looks ridiculous. I know it can't possibly work, but it does. So that's the first point of call. Then you can actually learn a bit more about breathing and breathing techniques, and that's really what it is. What you do is you sit down and you breathe in a way that oxygenates you, and you can, in the process of doing these techniques, slow your heart down. One of the things they did to prove the point to me in Thailand was put a pulse rate monitor on me and got me to do this nostril breathing for 2 minutes, during which my heart rate halved.
Wow.
So it does, I don't know why it works. Bear in mind that we also did things like Reiki and Theta healing and all that kind of stuff. Oh. And I have to say, none of that worked for me. I couldn't find anything in any of it. Having said that, it works for other people. And look, Stephen, the thing is, we're also, so many people are struggling with mental health issues, with well-being issues, whether it be weight issues or self-confidence issues or anxiety or depression or all of these things. And they're all linked with our food, and they're all linked with actually the speed of life that we live. I mean, I've done this cookbook to try and get people to spend some time cooking things that would suit themselves. I found that when I wanted to eat vegetarian and vegan, there wasn't the food out there for big people like me who are working outside in the cold and coming home to get a full, wholesome bowl of food. So I did this because this was what I was cooking for me.
So what do you eat now rather than a burger or a sausage or a steak?
All right, so for example, when I get in this evening, because I've got my sons coming around and they're big eaters, I'm going to be making a big, thick vegetable chestnut stew with Parmesan and herb dumplings. So that's a vegan version of it.
I should know this, and sorry that I don't. Are you married? Are you single?
I'm married, but we are now separated. I have a 2.5-year-old son, and we are now separated. So
okay, so you're cooking on your own is the reason I'm asking the question. Is
that
right?
But I spent the last 8 years in my marriage cooking for my wife, who was veggie. So that kind of helps. I've always cooked anyway. Cooked with my sons, both my elder sons are really good cooks, and I'm already cooking with my 2.5-year-old. So he enjoys baking. It's kind of messy, like painting, but with the result, you get a nice cake at the end of it, which is quite good fun.
2.5-year-old wee boy. Wow, yeah. Beautiful. And I guess that is that perspective, isn't it, between work and family and children.
Oh, it has to be. I mean, that's the thing. You know, early on in life, when my older kids were growing up, I was you know, busy trying to make a living and trying to get through this business, which, as you know, is
it's crazy.
A constant tightrope that somebody gives a shake every now and again. And after 32 years, I'm still hanging onto the tightrope and still in there. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
So, with my older kids, I wasn't around as much as I'd have liked to have been. And of course, now there's a slightly different vibe on it because I'm 54 now. And I've got a 2.5-year-old son, and if I'm going to be around for him when he grows up, I've got to do something about making sure I stay healthy.
And that's part of why you're staying healthy?
Yeah, part of it's that. Part of the motivation is that. Part of the fact is actually getting to a point in my life where I want to be slightly kinder to me. You know, I was the engine that I've in the car that I've put 100,000 miles on the clock and done it all at 100 miles an hour. That's got to be doing some damage to the engine over a period of time. And if I'm also sticking the wrong fuel in it, it's not doing it any good. And you can actually the changes when you stick the right fuel in it are dramatic. I mean, bear in mind, look, we're both documentary makers. So when I took these guys to Thailand for this retreat to do all these different techniques, I measured them in a hospital at the beginning and at the end to make sure they were there. And the results were off the scale. You actually eat a plant-based diet more regularly. We had a type 2 diabetic with us, a guy who was type 2 diabetic, had been for 4 years. Within a week of eating raw vegan, when we tested him in the hospital, he was no longer showing as type 2 diabetic. It's within our control to be able to control type 2 diabetes by the food that we eat. For the rest of us, blood pressure dropped by a third during the 23 days that I was out there. I lost 9 kilos in weight. I was the doctor that saw me at the end at the hospital said if I'd presented having dropped 9 kilos in any other circumstances, he'd be testing me for all kinds of different tropical diseases. But all the other signs, like my blood pressure, all showed that I was incredibly healthy. It was actually like pressing a reset button. And the trouble was that whole vegan tribe can be quite militant. Yeah. And quite difficult to be part of. And my builders and taxi drivers looked at them and thought, I don't want to become part of that tribe, which stops people trying the food, which isn't fair because it's too good and too healthy. And mates of mine say, well, look, I can't give up meat. I don't want them to give up meat, but you should be trying to give up meat maybe once a week, twice a week, three times a week.
Have you given that up completely?
No, I haven't. I'm what the Californians would describe as flexitarian. So as I said to you before, I'm like, I used to eat meat 3-4 times a day. Last year, I ate meat probably, oh, don't know, in the last year, probably 10 or 12 times. So if I go around a mate's house and he's cooked me something like a chicken casserole, I'll eat it because I don't want to embarrass him and say, I'm sorry, I've suddenly turned vegan.
And I'm guessing this healthier body then has...
Oh, it's magnificent. If only you were here in the room to see it.
Has improved your mind. Listen. I went on this crazy diet 2 years ago, right? And I lost it. I put it all on again, needless to say. But I think I lost 6 stone in 10 weeks or something. It was crazy. But as I said at the time, I couldn't walk around. I was like a 17-year-old, for goodness sake. I had erections everywhere I walked. The BBC don't like me saying this, but it's true. It's factually true. It is amazing how your whole body just becomes younger when you stop putting crap into it.
It is absolutely extraordinary. And I'm just, can you hear me editing the four or five things I was about to say then?
Yes. That was me prompting to see if the same thing has happened to you, Mr. Knowles.
Life has been good, but at a bad time when I've suddenly become single again. So, mind you, it's on the upside, there are upsides and downsides to everything, aren't there? So I suppose that's the way to think of it. So, but yes, life is good.
So as, you know, the majority of this interview actually has been about, I guess, you and I and others listening, as you know, what does it mean to be a whole person and to be content, I guess. Now that you've improved your body, are you slightly more content in your head?
Oh God, yeah. That's the whole thing. You can't, the food and mind go together. Anybody who is depressed knows that what they eat will make a massive difference to depression. I'm doing this big mental health documentary at the moment, or around the London Marathon with members of the young members of the royal family, and some amazing people who suffer various different mental health issues have let us into their lives to be really open and to give other people an idea. Well, there's several things. One is to give people might recognise in themselves that they might have issues that they could get help with on a day-to-day basis. The other is to try and let other people understand what it's like to live with mental health issues, and how to be around people that you love and care about who have mental health issues, because all of these things we're not very good at. And the connection between mental health and food, i.e. well-being, and the trouble is well-being sounds like such a hippie term, yeah. but well-being is genuinely it. The connection between mental health and food is huge. Yeah. So if you can get the one side ticking over nicely, the other side tends to come with it. Food, exercise, it's not rocket science. If that if you exercise a bit, you'll feel better straight away.
Yeah.
You can actually, people talk about, you know, like they spend all kinds of money on serums and things to try and to get their youth back. Youth-defying serums and creams and, do you know what, actually go get out and have a long walk, go for a jog, get your body parts like working again. That's actually what is life extending.
Yeah, friend,
and youthful, and same with the food. If you're eating stuff with additives, with preservatives, with sugars and salts crammed into it, if you're not eating naturally, if you're not eating healthy, if you're eating too much meat and not enough plant-based diet, all of these things, too much dairy, we know all of these things aren't good for them. It's not like I'm coming up with this radical idea. We've known for 2,000 years, Julius Caesar's army was vegetarian. He wouldn't let them eat meat because it knew it slowed them down, made them sluggish and made them old before their time.
Your new book is called Proper Healthy Food. I've really enjoyed this today, actually. I like you. I'm sure you don't care, but I do. And thank you so much for talking to us, Nick. Hope to meet you sometime.
It's been a real joy, and I shall continue to listen to you both here and on Radio 5 Live as I'm driving around on my ridiculous schedule.
And stop working so much.
Heal thyself.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
That's it for today. Thanks for your company. Have a good weekend. See you Monday.